Shalom. Welcome to the third installment of Teaching Halakha, a podcast about teaching Halakha. Each installment of approximately 15 minutes will discuss a specific pedagogic issue, using examples drawn from my experience teaching in high schools, on university campuses, in high-level Batei Midrash, and in diverse communities at large. My name is Aryeh Klapper, and I serve as Dean of the Center for Modern Torah Leadership, or CMTL. CMTL develops present and future modern Orthodox leaders, male and female, through unique programs of intense Talmud Torah that catalyze intellectual creativity and educational innovation. For more information about our programs, please visit torahleadership.org, follow us on Facebook, and join our mailing list. My core claim in the first two installments has been that we need to think about teaching halakha curricularly. I don't mean that we need an independent halakha curriculum, but rather that we need to think about how halakha is taught throughout the curriculum, and indeed throughout our students' lives. My corollary claim is that we teach halachic process whether we want to or not. The only open question is whether we teach it well or badly. Today I want to make this corollary claim very concrete and talk about it in the context of teaching a specific and very familiar text, the first Mishnah of Masechet Brachot. The Mishnah begins with a statement, apparently consensus, that the earliest time to recite the evening Shema is when the Kohanim enter to eat Truma. It then presents three positions as to the end time for the evening Shema. Rabbi Eliezer says the end of the first watch, the Chachamim or the sages say halfway through the night or Chatzot, and Rabban Gamliel says until dawn or Amud HaShachar. We then have a Maaseh, a narrative, in which Rabban Gamliel's sons return from a wedding after Chatzot without having read the Shema. He tells them that they are obligated, or in some versions permitted, to read the Shema. Then he, or possibly the editor, makes a general claim that wherever the sages said until Chatzot, their mitzvah is until dawn. Two specific and unrelated instances are given of laws that apply until dawn, although commentators note that the sages said until midnight regarding only one of them. Rabbi Gamliel, or the editor, then concludes, if so, why did the sages say until chatzot, so as to distance a person from sin? Most students and teachers think about this Mishnah through the lens of a beautiful sugya on Brachot 9a, explicating the conversation between Rabbi Gamliel and his sons. Let's listen in as Rabbi A teaches it to his class. And until now, the sons never heard Rabbi Gamliel's position? The Gemara assumes that Rabbi Gamliel's sons were actually aware of all three positions in the Mishnah. They knew that their father held that the time for Shema had not expired. So what then was their purpose in telling him that they had not yet recited? Of course he would tell them to recite it. The sugya answers as follows. Hachik Amrile. This is what Rabbi Gamliel's sons really said to him. Rabbanan pligi ilaveich, v'yachid v'rabim halacha k'rabim, v'odilma, Rabbanan kavateich sfirilhu, v'hayde kamriyad chatzot, k'dei l'harchik adam min ha'avera. Amarlhu, Rabbanan kavasi sfirilhu, v'chayavin atem, v'hayde kamriyad chatzot, k'dei l'harchik adam min ha'avera. The position attributed to the sages can be understood in two ways. They might have held that the deraita time of Shema, derived from b'shach b'chov k'umecha, extends until Chatzot. In that case, the principle of Yachid v'Rabim would mean that the law follows the sages against Rabbi Gamliel, and the sons would not be able to follow his position. Or, the sages might have agreed with Rabbi Gamliel that B'shach B'chov K'mecha means until dawn. In that case, the sons would be able to follow their father's opinion, otherwise what's the point of their question? It's true that the sages said only until Chatzot, but that was only to distance people from sin. Okay. What have Rabbi A's students learned about halacha? Lesson 1, the halacha always follows the majority. Isn't that the presumption of the sons? They don't seem interested at all in knowing which position is correct, only in which position the sages hold. Number 2, the Rabbanan positions are really only educational devices, and the rabbis don't really mean their positions as law. Otherwise, why would it matter that the sages agree with Rabbi Gamliel on a deraita level? They still are the rabbim in their disagreement with him on the derabbanan level, so the sons should not be able to follow him. Are these the lessons we want our students to learn about halakha from this Mishnah? Very likely as their introduction to halachic process. I think it's obvious that we don't want students to learn the second lesson, that all derabbanans are not really law, more like guidelines. We want them to take derabbanans with great seriousness. We want them to understand why Chazal sometimes made the standard for waiving derabbanans higher than the standard for waiving a Torah prohibition. Yet we also want them to keep the fundamental hierarchy in their heads. We also want them to understand why the whole concept of the Rabbanans does not violate Baal Tosif, even if they haven't yet really heard of Baal Tosif or don't have the synthetic minds that would raise this question automatically. So how can we avoid having them learn this lesson that Derabbanans are not really law? First, we can tell the students that this Derabbanan is not actually law, more like a guideline, but that most Derabbanans are law. But there's a long-term educational risk when the first example students see is an exception. Some of them will keep using it as the rule for at least a while. Second approach, we can argue that the Chachamim Rabbi Gamliel weren't really arguing. One stated the law d'oraita, the other law d'rabbanan, and the d'rabbanan law was only l'chatchila. But this makes the Mishnah's presentation of their positions as if they were arguing, as if there is a machloket, very atypical. It's not unknown to present positions that way, but atypical, and it has the same educational risk as the first case, that some students will see the exception as the rule. Third approach, we can claim that the Chachamim and Rabbi Gamliel were arguing, but they were only arguing on the l'chatchila level. The Chachamim held that there's a mitzvah d'rabbanan to fulfill the mitzvah d'oraita by midnight, and Rabbi Gamliel disagreed. He said that midnight isn't necessary at all. In this version, we still rule against Rabbi Gamliel, and we think that l'chatchila, when it's supposed to fulfill the mitzvah by midnight, just once the sun's missed chatzot, there's no longer a dispute about what they should do. The question is whether students will understand b'di'evid you're still yotze as different than the Chachamim are only giving guidelines. But even if not, one has at least sown the seeds of deeper understanding. Fourth approach, we can bracket the question by claiming that children have a special right or obligation to follow the parents' halachic position, and this right or obligation can override majority rule, at least in the case of derabbanans. This will hopefully lead to fascinating questions down the line, and schools taking this approach need to consider how they will in fact react to students insisting that they have a right to behave in school as their parents do at home with regard to issues of halakha. It matters which of these choices we take, and for subsequent teachers to know which choice was taken, and for everyone to understand that ignoring the whole issue probably yields the worst pedagogic result. What about the first lesson, that the halakha always follows the majority, except perhaps for children following their parents in the case of the rabbanans? I have a pet peeve here. The rabbinic phrase Yachid v'rabim halakha k'rabim should not be translated as follow the majority. The correct translation is, when an individual and a group are in dispute, the law follows the group. This is different than acharei rabim la'tot, which can mean follow the majority or at least follow the plurality. But acharei rabim la'tot applies only to votes on a beit din, or to a voter consensus of all the relevant scholars in a community. To make it relevant here, you would have to teach the students either that Rabbi Gamliel's position lost a vote on the Sanhedrin, or else that a majority of the editorial board of the Mishnah voted for the Chachamim. Neither of these seems obvious. So let us suppose that our Mishnah is not reporting the result of a vote of all the parties mentioned, let alone a formal Beit Din meeting. Rather, it is presenting a machloket that was never debated in person by the original Baalei Machloket, and the text was not altered by the editors of the Mishnah to reflect their own vote. What then does the phrase Yachid v'Rabim mean here? One possibility is that we are dealing not with the principle of formal authority, but rather with an informal heuristic. Usually, what more or most people think is more likely to be the halakha, whether because they are objectively more likely to be correct, or else because it makes sense to decide the halakha in the way that creates the least cognitive dissonance in the community. An informal rule is highly susceptible to confounding factors. Moreover, this rule loses force as the numbers increase. 2 against 1 might have much greater significance than 3 against 2, and 200 against 199 has no significance at all. It should also be clear that this sort of rule has relevance only within a community of discourse. Truth, for example, is not determined by birth rate. That your community has more children does not make you more likely to be correct. Furthermore, the Talmud indicates the Yachid v'Rabim halakha k'rabim is far from an absolute rule, at least if understood as describing the outcomes of halachic disputes. It turns out that there are quite a few possibly confounding factors, ranging from counter-rules, such as b'drabbanan halacha achar ha-mekil, follow the leading position regarding drabbanans, or Rabbi Yossi nimuko imo, Rabbi Yossi is particularly impressive analytic individuals, and therefore we rule like him, even against multiple colleagues, to a simple capacity to rule like the individual, Mishum de mistaber t'ame, because his rationale is intuitively attractive. An entirely different possibility is the Yachid v'Rabim halakha k'rabim is not a substantive principle at all. It tells us nothing about how we should settle contemporary halachic disputes, or for that matter past halachic disputes in which we assemble positions holding each way. Rather, it is a literary principle of the Mishnah, or perhaps of certain kinds of Tannaitic literature or literature about Tannaim generally. When the editor of a text presents a position as that of a group against an individual, that means that the editor intends us to paskin that way. But we need to be aware that the editor has the privilege of calling the position he or she likes that of the Chachamim, even if it was originally stated by one Tana, and also that the Talmud reserves to itself the right to expose the editor's work and not to rule the way that he or she wanted us to. Now all this is a whole lot to explain to beginning students, and much of it may be unfamiliar to teachers as well, as perhaps they were educated in a system that did not teach halakha systematically or curricularly. There are many other ways to complicate the picture of halachic process presented by the sugya. For example, Talmidei Rabbeinu Yonah hold that the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Gamliel even b'diavad, and hold that one may not read the Shema after midnight. If we adopt this interpretation, the sons would be following their father even though, according to the sages, the Rabbim, it is forbidden to do so, in other words, despite the rule of Yachid v'Rabbim halachaki Rabbim. We can also complicate this picture by introducing additional texts. For example, on Ched Amud Bet, Rav Yehuda in the name of Shmuel states boldly that the halacha follows Rabbi Gamliel. One might say this means only as against Rabbi Eliezer, but the simple reading is clearly even against the Chachamim. The Gemara on Ched Amud Bet also cites, and Amoraim at least apparently rule, in accordance with the position that permits saying Shema B'diavad even until Hanetzach Hama, sunrise, which seems against every position in the Mishnah, if one understands Rabbi Gamliel's limit as Diaraita. The Talmud on Daled Amud Bet seems to require reading the Shema L'chatchila immediately upon coming home, even if that is well before midnight. We can also explicitly and directly complicate the process issues by citing the stories, such as the one on 27b, in which Rabban Gamliel appears to believe that the Nasi has authority that trumps all. On the basis of those stories, we might argue that perhaps Rabban Gamliel's ruling for his sons reflects this general approach to halacha, and perhaps our approach is not the same as his. Introducing alternate interpretations or additional texts are techniques that require raising the level of study. Teachers with students for whom multiple interpretations and intertexts are appropriate, and who will therefore be introducing at least some of these complications anyway, should be careful to prepare students for them, and to point out the ways in which they change their understanding of both the content and process of halacha. Teachers who are teaching Gemara rather than Mishnah will presumably reach some of these texts anyway. Students at every level of our Torah educational system are struggling with questions of halachic legitimacy and authority, so we need to do better in teaching halachic process. In this installment, I hope to have successfully given us a better idea of what we should be aiming for, but there's a long road to go yet before we get there. Please stay tuned. Comments and questions are very welcome and should be sent to Aryeh Clapper at dean@torahleadership.org.